Good morning. Last week we looked at the first of our series on identity, on who do you think you are. We looked at the wonderful fact that you are made in the image of God. Nothing can take that away. You are special. You are made in the image of God. Today we come to the not so nice side of people. I don't know if you've noticed, sometimes people do horrendous things and then hopefully the police swoop in and you get the murderer, the kidnapper, the paedophiles arrested. And then the TV crews, they often come in after that and they interview the neighbours. Have you seen these the shots? And that they're interviewing the neighbour and the neighbour's shocked. Oh, I can't believe this could happen here. How could they do this? They seem like such a normal person. And everybody's surprised. A normal person has done a terrible thing. Almost every time, it seems. How can it be that normal people do bad things? This week a friend of mine posted an article on Facebook. Why do good people do bad things? It was an article from Business Insider and had 16 reasons that good people do evil, do bad things. My friend posted it with a comment saying, even politicians. She wasn't a big fan of the budget. And their first point was that people sometimes do bad things when they're committed to an ideology like national security or like small government. Even politicians, she said. But it was actually quite a good article because it summarised the findings from psychological research and different things from psychs from around the world nice and concisely into 16 reasons why good people do bad things. Let me run you through a couple. If people feel that they are labelled as bad, they often do evil. You know, so people say I'm bad, well I'm going to show them how really bad I am. Doesn't matter anyway. But then on the other hand, I noticed another one said that if we feel we've been especially good, if we feel we've been particularly ethical, then we say, well, I've got so much credit, doesn't matter if I just do this bit of a cheat here. So if you feel you're bad, you can do evil. And if you feel you're good, you can do evil. And it struck me, and I looked through actually the 16 reasons, and I've rephrased them because I noticed that a lot of them seem to have both sides. If the environment is too controlling, you kick against it, and you do bad things a lot of the time in rebellion. But if the environment is not controlling enough, people tend to do evil because they can get away with it. If people feel powerful, they may misuse their power and do evil. But if people feel powerless and undervalued, they'll strike out and do evil. If they are positioning themselves to get more power, they'll often do bad things on the way. Power goes every way. When the authorities give no consequences for evil, give permission to do whatever, people do stuff. If they try to give fines as consequences, what it becomes is an economic transaction. So instead of thinking, I must not speed because I could kill people, you think, well, what are the risks of getting caught and what's the cost of the fine? Ever done it? Or we relabel crimes. So we relabel bribery, so it becomes greasing the wheels, and there are other sort of tax minimisation. We relabel other people, so it becomes easier to do evil to them. Or we find if we can hide behind an ideology, if we hide behind a uniform. They actually physically put a mask on people and given them a chance to give other people electric shocks. And if they've got a mask on, they give them bigger shocks. If we can hide, and it's not all, if we're hungry, people do more bad things. And if people are tired, they do more bad things. Amazing the array of reasons. You know, it seems to me like you take people, you add an excuse, and up shoots evil. It's amazing the different ways that we could find to do bad things. Excuses, reasons, whatever. I've been learning more about gardening the last few years. Now, if I've got a garden, okay, the experts in this might be able to help me more on this. If I've got a garden, and in one section there, I add sheep poo to the garden and I water it, and as well as the good plants, up shoot weeds. That's not good, okay? And then on another section, same dirt, I plant grass, add lawn builder, water it, and up shoot weeds in the midst of the grass. And then I pull out the weeds from the garden bed, and I add blood and bone. And what comes up again? More weeds. I pull them up, try seaweed fertilizer. What do I get? Weeds. Now, if I'm getting that problem, do you think it's just the fertilizer I'm adding? Do you think it's just the outside things coming in? It's probably beyond that, isn't it? Wouldn't it be Rex and Betty? It's that there are weeds in the dirt, deep down, embedded there, just waiting for the opportunity to spring up. Waiting for the opportunity to sprout. Well, listen to what Jesus has to say about people. If you could turn to the reading that Miriam read from Mark chapter 7, starting at verse 14 on page 998 of the church Bibles there. So at this stage, Jesus has been debating with the religious leaders of his day what it is that makes people unclean. What makes people bad? And the religious leaders have been saying that really it's the stuff that comes from outside, and it's your outward actions that you do that make people bad. You know, they're saying you're unclean before God if you break rules. If you look clean on the outside, they're saying, then you are clean. You don't take bad stuff in, you'll be okay. But then Jesus says in chapter 7, verse 14, listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside a person, nothing outside a man can make him unclean by going into him. Rather, it's what comes out of a man that makes him unclean. And his disciples go, what? They don't get it. And later on, he has explained to them in verse 18, are you so dull? Don't you see that nothing that enters a man from outside can make him unclean? It doesn't go into his heart, but his stomach. And then it continues, verse 20, what comes out of a man? What comes out of a person is what makes him unclean. For from within, out of people's hearts come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a person unclean. Where does Jesus say the problem comes from? It's inside. And some people find this really radical. You know, I go through this passage reasonably often because I go through it as part of marriage preparation with couples. And so here you've got these two couples with stars, two people with stars in their eyes. He's finally found the woman who's not like any other girl. And she has found the man. And all right, there might be some tensions at the moment, but this is a special right. There are tensions there only because of the wedding stress. Planning a wedding, it's hugely stressful. You never try and do wedding prep in the last month because they're just a mess. Okay, but they're saying, well, once we're past that initial chaos, then everything will be okay. Then we've got a beautiful relationship and it'll all be wonderful. It'll all be great. But Jesus says, hey, you get past the wedding and fixing your house and your finances, it won't get rid of the problems. The problems will rise up from within, even from within your beautiful bride. In from within that wonderful man. So one day it'll come and she'll look at him and go, where did that selfish pig come from? And he'll look at her and he'll probably be even harsher. And then maybe in a few days he'll actually wake up and cool down and look at himself and say, whoa, how could I have hurt her like that? I can't believe I said that. I thought I was a good person. Well, Jesus says, from the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks, Luke 6:45. You know, there's only one way to get around marrying someone with a sick heart. Don't get married. But even then you won't solve the problem. Because you still have to encounter people in life. And people with this problem are everywhere. Your friends, they might look nice on the outside. You might think you can select your friends and just have the good people you hang out with. And then one day, you know, you just do one little thing and they blow up at you. You ever had that experience? Or maybe you turn to your mate in the hour of need and he runs away. Why do normal people do bad things? Because normal people have a sickness in their heart. The Bible calls this sickness sin. So, what is sin? Especially, what's at the heart of sin? See, Jesus makes it clear sin isn't just the bad things we do. I mean, Jesus lists, in that list there was sexual immorality, theft, murder and adultery. But he also includes, in case you're starting to think, I don't do those things, maybe thinking I do, but maybe thinking I don't do those things, evil thoughts, coveting, wanting what other people have, deceit, envy, slander, how to go at them, pride. Jesus says the real problem is inside. At its heart, sin isn't an outward action. At its heart, it's in the heart. And it's an attitude. And we can see this attitude of sin through the Bible. And I want to go back to the very first sin, which we'll read from Genesis chapter 3. And as we look at that, we'll also see, well, I know that I find every time I look at it, I can identify with it. I can see this attitude of sin in my own heart. I'm going to look at three things which have been identified as being at the heart of sin. Firstly, sin is unfaith. Miriam said, is that a word? She looked it up in the dictionary. It officially is a word, unfaith. It's but failing to trust God. Martin Luther, the great German reformer, he explained sin as unfaith. Or more importantly than Martin Luther is what says in the Bible in Romans 14, verse 23, whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. So in the garden in Genesis, when the serpent tempts the woman, he goes up and he suggests to her, hey, maybe God's keeping good things away from you. Maybe God doesn't really want what's best for you and for the man. And now the woman's got an opportunity here. She can review what God's given her, review the way God's treated her, review what he's done. That God has given the man and the woman each other, beautiful in the image of his own image. God's placed them in a stunning garden. He's given them good work to do, looking after it. That's actually fulfilling. And he's given them all the trees of the garden to eat from, except so just one. Okay, guys, just one. Don't eat from that one. Just trust me, it's not good for you. So does the woman say, hey, if God's given me so much, I know I can trust him. God isn't cheating us. Does she do that? No. She accepts the lie that God's holding something back from her. At the heart of sin is a failure to trust God. At the heart of sin is unfaith. And secondly, sin is lawlessness. 1 John 3 verse 4 says, everyone who commits sin is guilty of lawlessness. Sin is lawlessness. Some of your translations will say sin is breaking God's law. That's a rough translation. More technical accurate is sin is lawlessness. Because lawlessness isn't just breaking a rule or two. Breaking the law. Lawlessness is rejecting the law, rejecting God's authority. Rejecting that God, who made the universe, has the right to be in charge. A lot of you here are parents. You know that when you give a kid a clear instruction, you're setting yourself a potential hurt, aren't you? Because, say if you say, do not do this or you'll get burnt, and you go to the other room, you hear a yell, ah! And you run in, and not only is he burnt, and you feel the pain of his burn, but you feel the pain of his rejection. He has chosen to ignore your authority. He's said he doesn't trust you effectively to make good rules. That's what he's saying when he's breaking it. Back in the garden, there was only one rule. Do not eat the fruit of this one tree. It's pretty clear. Either you accept God's authority and obey this rule, or you reject God's authority, you reject him, you become a lawbreaker. And the woman chose lawlessness. And, so, and I love this. Where's the guy all this time? What's he saying? He's the one who was given the law in the first place. The man standing there silently. He chooses to reject the law by ignoring it. Acting as if God didn't give the law at all. I don't have any responsibilities. See, some of us reject God's law actively by deliberately breaking it. Others reject it passively by ignoring God's law. Either way, we're choosing to be lawless. Sin is lawlessness. It's rejecting God's law. But sin's not just what we reject. Rejecting God, not trusting him, rejecting his law, lawlessness. Sin is also what we want to add. Sin is wanting to build up our own authority. As Augustine of Hippo, the famous theologian at the end of the Western Roman Empire, said, sin is pride. Sin is saying, I know better than you, God. I'll choose for myself what is right. So in the garden, what does the serpent tell the woman so attractive about the eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? The serpent says, you will be like God. You will. Knowing good and evil. You'll be like God. In other words, you will be your own God. This is personal. This is saying, God, you're not needed. God, you're not wanted. I have me. Sin is pride. You'll be like God, knowing good and evil. You'll be able to decide for yourself what is good. You'll be the one who is the judge, who declares what's evil. In other words, you'll be the judge, you'll be the ruler. What do we call this in politics? If you've got a section of a kingdom that declares, hey, we don't want the ruler, we want to be in charge, make our own rules the way we want to, our own laws. Yeah, we call it a rebellion. Well, in eastern Ukraine, they like to call it a declaration of autonomy. In the Ukraine, there's a debate about just how many people do reject the central government and how many really want autonomy. But when it comes to declaring autonomy from God, the number of rebels is clear. I don't know, as we looked at the nature of sin, every time I do this, I know it includes me. We're all rebels. We are all sinners. As Paul writes in Romans 3, there is no one righteous, not even one. No one who understands. No one who seeks God. A little further on, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All of us. We all have this sickness in our heart that we call sin. Now you might be new to church today. If so, we're really glad that you're here. It's a great place for people who don't know Jesus yet. But you might be saying, well, you say I've got a problem? Well, actually, yes. Jesus says we've all got a problem. There's good news to come, but you've got to grasp this bad news is the reason we need the good news. And the bad news is we're all rebels. We express our rebellion in different ways. Our sin's shown in different forms. But the same problem in our heart is at the root of every sin. I'm going to give you three examples. I'm going to use three sins that are pretty widely accepted in our society. Or maybe some of them may not be widely accepted, but they're definitely widely practiced. I think surveys show about half the people at least in the community, or over a quarter for every one of them, including amongst Christians. Firstly, cheating on your tax. Now this might, I must admit, this week this might be extremely tempting to various people after the budget. Cheating on taxes, though, is not just a rejection of the authority of the government. Cheating on taxes is a rejection of the authority of Jesus. Jesus himself said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. We saw that last week. But cheating on taxes is also telling God, I don't trust you, God. I don't trust you to look after me. I don't trust that if I live your way, you will be there for me. I need to break your law. I need to grab more for myself. And God, I'll decide if this is okay. Not you, God. That's what we're saying. It's the heart of sin. Second example, gossiping. Gossiping is not only a sin against others because we're putting them down to make ourselves more popular. When you gossip, you're rejecting God's authority, and the Bible's quite clear. Do not gossip. When we gossip, we tell God, God, I don't trust you for my acceptance, for my approval. I need the approval of others to feel good. Say to God, I don't care what you say about gossip. I don't care what you say about loving my neighbour as myself, because I wouldn't want it done to me. No, God, I'm in charge of the way I talk, not you. Third example, watching pornography, porn. You know, people might say, or hear it around, that watching porn isn't really a problem because you're off by yourself. I could go into why the social scientists say that that's wrong, and that porn does hurt you and does all sorts of things to your brain, but that's not our focus today. But, you know, another people might say, well, porn doesn't really matter that much. I'm only breaking a little rule about lust. But God is deeply offended every time you watch porn. You are taking His good gifts that He's given you. What are you doing with them? Women who God has created in His own image. You dehumanize them, strip them back to be nothing but sex objects. And then there's God's good gift of sex. The good gift He's given to people to bond a man and a woman together for life. And you tell God, oh, nah, I don't really care what you say about sex. I want what I want. I want my thrill, my way, right now. You're telling God, I don't trust what you say is good. I don't trust you, God. I know better. Sin comes from the heart. And so sin breaks the law, and so there is a punishment that must follow. But it's not just legal. Sin is personal. When we sin, I mean, a lot of the time, do we think it's bad? A lot of the time, if we sin, we'll often say, yeah, that was bad, if it hurts other people. And it's often true. But that's not the worst part of sin. When we sin, some of us accept that it's bad because we're breaking God's law. It's true. When we break the law, there must be a consequence to pay. But it doesn't stop there. We must never forget that when we sin, we're rejecting the God who made us. Rejected the God who loves us. Sin's personal. God is a personal being. Our relation, the way we relate as people, is in His image. He is relational. He is loving. Our sin is profoundly personal. It's a rejection of God Himself. And God is deeply and personally offended by our sin, all our sin. In the book of Hosea, God compares the pain He feels over His people's sin to that of a devoted husband, a loving husband who gives his wife every good thing. But his wife continually runs off and cheats on him. She takes all the good things he's given her and throws it away with her other lovers. Rips his guts out. God's anger at our sin is personal. God's a righteous judge who can't allow lawbreakers to go unpunished. And God also says that He is a jilted lover, like a jilted lover, who can't let the relationship go on this way. So sin has consequences. And these consequences, they are serious. As sinners, our relationship with God is in big trouble. But God is still merciful to us, as He was merciful to the first man and woman. He allows us to go on living in His world. He keeps giving us the ability to have relationships. But eventually, if we remain as sinners, God must end His relationship with us. He must take away the good things, all the good things that He's given to us. And one word for when that happens is hell. Well, here's a second view of it, it's the same outcome. God is the rightful ruler of the world, the rightful ruler of our lives. And so eventually He'll come in and crush the rebellion. Or another way, God is the righteous lawmaker and judge who wants to see perfect justice. And so eventually He has to come in judgment for those who reject the law. And the wages of sin is death. That's what I deserve. That's what we all deserve. But amazingly, God has given us another option. God created you in His image. You are special. You are loved. And God loves you so much that He offers you life through Jesus Christ. We deserve death. I deserve death. But He offers me, He offers you life. Jesus Christ, God's own Son, came and lived as a man. Jesus always trusted His Father, not living in unfaith like us. Jesus always obeyed God's law. He wasn't lawless like we are. Jesus humbly maintained His relationship with God all His life. And then Jesus Christ went to the cross, where He took on Himself the wages of sin. Jesus was rejected, tortured, killed, to take the punishment that sinners deserve, that sinners like you, like me deserve. So on the cross, Jesus defeated sin. On the cross, Jesus paid the price for sin. And then He rose again, as we sang, we rise this morning. He is the risen ruler. He is the risen Lord. So now, if you trust in Jesus' death, if you live with Jesus as your ruler and Lord, then you can know that all the punishment for your sin has been taken. Complete forgiveness. You have nothing to fear when God comes in judgment, because God looks at you and He sees Jesus' perfection covering your sin. In fact, when God looks at you, He sees a saint. God then sends His Spirit to work in you, to help you live as the saint you already are in Christ. But I'm getting carried away. That's next week's sermon. We'll leave that till then. Today, we're talking about sin. Sin's not a popular topic. I'm not sure what most of you thought this morning when you woke up, but I have a suspicion that you didn't think, what will I do today? I know. I'll go and hear about sin. It's much more attractive to talk about love. Most people don't like to think of themselves as sinners. They like to think of themselves as good people. So does it matter then? Do we really need to understand sin? Well, Jesus seemed to think we did. When He met the people who thought they were good people, Jesus spent a lot of time debating them, showing the people who thought they were good people that was vitally important, that they recognised they have a problem on the inside. We need to recognise we're sinners. Why? I'm just going to pick up two reasons why it's vital that you understand sin. Two consequences if you don't understand sin. Firstly, if you don't understand sin, you'll concentrate on appearances, on the outside. How do you respond when your sin is exposed? What's more important to you? Repenting and turning back to God? Or limiting the public damage? You know, the celebrity, the politician, you see them caught out, and they stand up and they give a public apology. I am sorry. But a lot of the time you think, what they really mean is, I am sorry I got caught. And why do we think we can tell that? What? Because it's inside us as well a bit, isn't it? Or you might say, I'm sorry if I hurt you. As if my sin only matters if other people feel hurt. No. All sin hurts God. The person who doesn't understand that sin is against God is more focused on what other people think, more focused on their public reputation than they are on obedience. It's more important that they look good than that they actually are good. The man who doesn't understand how deeply sinful he is will fool himself into thinking, hey, I am a good man. He'll seek approval from others to maintain that delusion. Avoid people who challenge it. The woman who doesn't understand how deeply, personally offensive sin is to God will think it's okay to sin in private. If you don't understand sin, you'll focus on appearances. And I encourage everybody to do this every year. Read through a gospel. But read through a gospel and see what Jesus said to the people who concentrated on appearances. They were called Pharisees. So if you don't understand sin, you'll concentrate on appearances. But more importantly, if you don't understand sin, you won't appreciate the cross. So if you don't understand sin, you tell yourself, I'm basically okay. You can think, hey, I just need a tiny bit of help from God. I need a helper. I don't really need saving. I just need a helper, someone to help, a little bit of a boost over the final hurdle. So with a bit of a boost from Jesus, you can make yourself fit to spend eternity with him. But where does that lead the cross? Did the perfect Son of God, the Lord of the universe, humble himself and suffer rejection and mocking and have nails driven through his hands just to give you a little bit of help? Did the mighty Lord of the universe suffer and die just to give you some weird good example? It's an example because it does something. It deals with sin. The reason Jesus came to earth, the reason he suffered so terribly, that he endured a terrible death, was because our sin is so terrible. And the consequences of our sin are horrific. I was lost, steeped in sin to the very core, sinful to my heart. I needed saving. Without a saviour, I have no hope. And how could I ever stand before the God who is perfect? How could I stand before him in my sin? But praise be to God that he sent Jesus, and my sin is paid for completely. I have a new life with Jesus who rose from the dead. Now Jesus brought me into the relationship that my sin had broken, into the relationship with God, so I could look forward to eternity rejoicing with my Creator. So please, please do not underestimate the power of sin or its pervasive influence in the world or the power of sin in my life and yours. You and I, we desperately need a Saviour. Know that, the bad news, but know also the great news. Never ever forget that on the cross, sin was defeated. It was paid for completely. The power of sin was broken by Jesus on the cross. Through him, not through our own efforts, not anything we could do. We are sinners, but through him, we have new life. See, if you recognize you're a sinner, if you recognize the bad news, then you are ready for the great news. That Jesus the Conqueror saves his people from sin and gives us real life.